U.S. President Joe Biden pardons his son, Hunter.
Perhaps that that bond between father and son should not have made this all too much of a surprise.
Iran is likely high on the agenda for Trump.
I'm not looking to be bad to Iran. We're going to be friendly, I hope, with Iran. Maybe, but maybe not. But they can't have a nuclear weapon. They can't have a nuclear weapon.
And protests in Georgia continue.
We've attended elections, and it was clearly rigged. And we've done everything in our power so far to show that we desire a European future.
Today is Monday, December 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strope. U.S. President Joe Biden has pardoned his son Hunter, sparing the younger Biden a possible prison sentence for federal felony gun and tax convictions and reversing his past promises not to use the extraordinary powers of the presidency for the benefit of his family members. The Democratic president had previously said he would not pardon his son or commute his sentence after his convictions in the two cases in Delaware and California. The move comes weeks before Hunter Biden was set to receive his punishment after his trial conviction in the gun case and guilty plea on tax charges, and less than 2 months before President-elect Donald Trump is set to return to the White House. Was this pardon a surprise, or was this expected? For more details, I spoke with VOA's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman.
I would say yes and no. Yes, in the sense that the White House, including the president, had denied he would do this, saying he would respect the results that came out from the jury. And also, Karine Jean-Pierre, the White House press secretary, repeatedly had said the president would not issue a pardon for his son. She had flat out said no and got curt with reporters who kept bringing it up and chiding them for continuing to ask the question. But there had been speculation that the president, who we know is very, very close with his son and has, despite all of the legal and personal troubles that Hunter Biden has had, has kept him close. So perhaps that that bond between father and son should not have made this all too much of a surprise.
Did the results of the U.S. presidential election play into this decision by President Biden at all? Or do we know if that was part of the decision or not?
There's no explicit indication of that, but Joe Biden, in his statement, does take a bit of a different tone, saying that the charges against his son came only after several of his political opponents in Congress instigated them to attack me and oppose my election. And he said that no reasonable person who looks after at the facts of his son's case can reach any other conclusion than Hunter was singled out because he is my son, said the president in a statement. And perhaps the president, looking at the situation with the president-elect, Donald Trump, of course, who is intending to nominate people that have their own brushes with the law in their past, and perhaps saying, well, you know, I don't care that this may tarnish my legacy a bit. It's going to be overshadowed by all of the things that would happen in the next administration. But, you know, what maybe we'll find out more in the days and weeks to come on this.
Steve Herman, chief national correspondent for VOA. Thank you very much for talking with me today.
My pleasure, Alexis.
A Vinnytsia resident lost his right arm in Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but even as an amputee, he is doing what he can to help other soldiers fight the war. VOA's Anna Kostashenko has the story.
39-year-old war veteran Vyacheslav Strazhets is teaching high schoolers how to operate drones as part of a new Defense of Ukraine course that was introduced in all Ukrainian schools in September 2024. Strazhets knows the subject all too well. He joined Ukraine's armed forces the day after Russia invaded Ukraine.
I had no prior combat experience, so I waited to see where they'd send me. As I waited, I trained and learned. Later, our Vinnytsia Battalion Angels, Unit 4038, was formed, and we headed east to defend Ukraine.
In May 2022, Strazhets was severely injured during an enemy mortar attack near Avdiivka.
Recovery for my right arm was brief. It was amputated, so that was it. The rehabilitation for my left arm took a lot longer. The index and middle fingers were completely non-functional for some time.
During rehabilitation, he came up with the idea to make drones. His wife helped him put the first few together, and later he learned to use his left hand and his prosthesis while soldering the drone pieces and looking for ways to continue to contribute to the war effort.
While looking for a way to help, I realized I couldn't hold a rifle anymore. But my long rehabilitation gave me plenty of time in the hospital with the phone and the internet, so I started doing online courses.
In October 2023, Stražec won a special grant for war veterans and founded his own drone manufacturing business called Strižtech. Stražec and three other veterans who work there produce an average of 50 drones per month. In October 2024, Stražec added teaching to his resume, incorporating his drones into the Defense of Ukraine classes he is now teaching. Despite being busy at his company, Stražec still teaches several times a week.
Unfortunately, this war will likely affect future generations. We were taught to be peaceful, to avoid nuclear weapons, but now we must tell our children the truth. I first thank them for staying in Ukraine, because many have already left. If you stay, you must learn to live and survive in this country.
Stražec's 15-year-old son Ilya is a high schooler as well, and after school he helps at his father's drone company. And while he's not sure what he wants to do with his life in the future, for now, like his dad, he's just trying to be useful as he can be. Anna Kostyuchenko for VO News, Vinnytsia region, Ukraine.
The rapid collapse of Syrian government forces inside and around the country's second largest city, Aleppo, has caught many observers by surprise. It's causing a domino effect on many parts of the country. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Rebel fighters who oppose Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, including those from the terrorist Jabhat al-Nusra group, fired weapons Saturday inside Syria's northern economic capital of Aleppo after the withdrawal of government forces from the city. Amateur video showed rebel fighters in control of Aleppo's central Saad al-Jabari Square, in addition to Aleppo University and the city's provincial government headquarters. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reported that Syrian government forces also withdrew from both Aleppo's civilian and military airports. Abu Dhabi-based Sky News Arabia showed amateur video of rebels apparently in control of the military airport. Britain-based Syrian analyst Rami Abdulrahman of the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights told Arab media that Iranian forces and their proxy militia allies have withdrawn from many positions in and around Aleppo.
Iran.
He says that Iranian Revolutionary Guard forces withdrew from the region after a drone attacked them and their allies, including Hezbollah and Iraqi Shiite militia forces, which pulled out alongside them. Arab media reported that the entire region between Aleppo and the rebel-controlled province of Idlib had fallen, and that large towns south of Aleppo on the main Aleppo-Damascus highway, including Sarakib and Marat al-Nauman, were also captured. It was not clear if other large Syrian cities would fall, but Joshua Landis, who heads the Middle East Studies program at the University of Oklahoma, told VOA that all eyes are now on Hama, which is Syria's fourth largest city. Landis said he believes it is possible the capital of Damascus may fall because government supporters are dispirited and have lost the will to fight. Despite Turkish government denials, Landis says the entire operation has Turkish fingerprints written all over it, since all the arms and food and money that enter Idlib come from Turkey.
I'm sure Turkey wanted to give Assad a big slap in the face and make him come to the table, but this is clearly set off a whole bunch of dominoes that I don't think anybody really expected.
Landis says there are several reasons for Assad's weakness, including Israel's pulling the stuffing out of his ally Hezbollah and the relentless Israeli pounding of Syrian government positions and those of their allies inside the country since the outset of the Gaza conflict on October 7, 2023. Syrian analysts also told Arab media that the Iran-Syria axis has been weakened since the road from Tehran to Beirut is no longer open and arms are no longer able to reach Iran's proxy militia allies. In addition, Syrian ally Russia has its hands tied at the moment because of its conflict with Ukraine. Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan denied that his government had any responsibility in the Syrian rebel onslaught on Aleppo. Turkey is playing an increasing role in trying to achieve peace in the region. Russian forces reportedly pulled out of several strategic positions in the region overnight, but Russian and Syrian warplanes bombed rebel forces in Aleppo and other parts of the region, causing numerous rebel casualties, according to the Syrian military. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. The top United Nations court will take up the largest case in its history on Monday. It opens 2 weeks of hearings into what countries worldwide are legally required to do to combat climate change and help vulnerable nations fight its devastating impact. Island nations who fear they could simply disappear under rising sea waters have lobbied for years for such a court case. Last year, the UN General Assembly asked the International Court of Justice for an opinion on the obligations of states in respect of climate change. The Roman Catholic Church has called on the president of El Salvador not to lift the country's ban on gold mining. Archbishop José Luis Escobar Alas asked President Nayib Bukele not to reverse the ban, which has been in place since 2017. Escobar Alas said it will damage this country forever. On Wednesday, Bukele called the seven-year-old ban on metals mining absurd and claimed unmined gold would be wealth that could transform El Salvador in comments on the social platform X. Bukele's party controls El Salvador's Congress by a wide margin, so a formal proposal to end the ban is unlikely to meet much resistance. Canada's ambassador to the United States says Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was successful in getting President-elect Donald Trump and some key cabinet nominees to understand that lumping Canada in with Mexico over the flow of drugs and migrants into the U.S. is unfair. Kirsten Hillman says Trudeau's dinner with Trump on Friday was a very important step in getting Trump to back away from threatened tariffs on all products. Trump threatened to impose tariffs on products from Canada and Mexico if they don't stop what he called the flow of drugs and migrants across their borders. Hillman says Trudeau's message that the Canadian border is so vastly different than the Mexican border was really understood. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope. Iran is likely to be high on the foreign policy agenda of the incoming Trump administration. The past year has seen the Islamic Republic engage in a major escalation of conflict with key U.S. ally Israel, while at the same time advancing its nuclear program to the point where it could rapidly produce enough fissile material for a bomb. VOA's Michael Lippin looks at what President-elect Trump and his team have said should be done about these threats.
On the campaign trail this year, then-presidential candidate Donald Trump made several conciliatory comments toward Iran, a U.S. foe whom he targeted with economic and military pressure in his first term.
I'm not looking to be bad to Iran. We're going to be friendly, I hope, with Iran. Maybe, but maybe not. But they can't have a nuclear weapon. They can't have a nuclear weapon.
Iran's Islamist rulers warned this year that they could drop a long-standing pledge to abstain from developing nuclear weapons if there is an external threat to their survival. In his first term, Trump withdrew from a 2015 deal that Iran made with world powers to curtail its nuclear program in return for sanctions relief. Trump said he sought a new deal that would be tougher on Tehran. A reporter asked him in September if he still wants to negotiate.
Sure, I would do that. We have to make a deal because the consequences are impossible.
In October, a podcaster asked Trump if he wants to see Iran's Islamist rulers replaced by the monarchy they overthrew in 1979.
We can't get totally involved in all it. You know, I mean, we can't run ourselves. Let's face it.
Sure. Trump used tougher rhetoric in response to Iran's October 1st ballistic missile attack on Israel. He noted that President Joe Biden told reporters Israel should not retaliate against Iranian nuclear sites.
I said, I think he's got that one wrong. Isn't that the what you're supposed to hit? But when they asked him that question, the answer should have been hit the nuclear first and worry about the rest later.
During his first term, Trump hit Iran with sanctions that choked off its oil exports and with an airstrike that eliminated its top military commander, Qasem Soleimani, in Baghdad. He did not say during this year's campaign whether he will use such tools again. But his nominee for Secretary of State, Senator Marco Rubio, is a strong advocate of that approach toward Iran. In an October post on X, Rubio wrote, "Only threatening the survival of the regime through maximum pressure and direct and disproportionate measures has a chance to influence and alter their criminal activities." Among those activities are what the U.S. Justice Department says was a foiled plot in which Iran recruited an Afghan to organize an assassination of Trump prior to Election Day. Tehran denied involvement, but Trump's choice for national security advisor said Iran should face consequences. Here was Republican Representative Michael Waltz speaking to the Atlantic Council on October 28th.
We need to be sending a message loud and clear that that is a red line that will never be tolerated to all of our adversaries, and that will come with massive repercussions. We have to restore deterrence.
What we don't know about President-elect Trump's approach to Iran is what kind of new deal he seeks and what he would do if he can't get one. Michael Lippin, VOA News, Washington.
Republican President-elect Trump nominated on Saturday former national security official and loyalist Kash Patel to lead the FBI, signaling an intent to oust the bureau's current director, Christopher Wray, whose 10-year term does not end until 2027, Reuters correspondent Diane Tao reports.
44-year-old Patel is a Trump loyalist who advised both the Director of National Intelligence and Secretary of Defense during the Republicans' first term in the White House. He has previously called for stripping the FBI of its intelligence-gathering role and purging its ranks of any employee who refuses to support Trump's agenda.
That victim is Donald J. Trump.
In a September interview on a conservative podcast, Patel said, quote, "The biggest problem the FBI has had has come out of its intel shops. I'd break that component out of it. I'd shut down the FBI Hoover Building on day one and reopen it the next day as a museum of the deep state." Current Director Wray's term does not expire until 2027. FBI directors are appointed to 10-year terms by law as a means of insulating the Bureau from politics. Trump himself appointed Wray to the role during his first term. But Wray has since come under fire from Trump and his supporters, who have accused the FBI and other federal agencies of weaponizing their law enforcement to silence critics on the right and target political enemies. It was under Wray that the FBI carried out a court-approved search at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate to look for classified documents. Wray has also faced criticism for his role overseeing a directive by Attorney General Merrick Garland aimed at working to protect local school boards from violent threats and harassment. An FBI spokesperson did not directly comment on Patel's nomination on Saturday, saying, quote, "Every day the men and women of the FBI continue to work to protect Americans from a growing array of threats. Director Wray's focus remains on the men and women of the FBI, the people we do the work with, and the people we do the work for." The appointment will need Senate approval. There will likely be pushback against Patel's nomination by Senate Democrats and possibly even some Republicans.
That was Reuters correspondent Diane Tao. President Joe Biden's visit to Angola, the first by a U.S. president to the Southwest African nation, centers around a rail corridor that will transport valuable minerals from the heart of the continent to a burgeoning Angolan port. He also will stress the need for stability and democracy to power the continent's engines of growth. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
Angola's president is a prominent figure on the continent, using his status as leader of a subcontinental oil giant to build influence and to work to settle regional conflicts. Now President João Lourenço welcomes a new and powerful friend, hosting President Joe Biden for the first visit to Angola by an American president. Biden will use the visit to highlight a major U.S. finance development project, the 1,300-kilometer Lobito Rail Corridor, which connects the mineral-rich African interior to the southwestern port. The U.S. says it has pulled together more than $3 billion in public and private money in U.S. investment on this project. The White House says the relationship between the two nations is undergoing a true transformation as they become closer partners. Karine Jean-Pierre is White House Press Secretary.
Together, the United States and Angola are working to address a full spectrum of pressing challenges, from narrowing the infrastructure gap in Africa and growing economic opportunities and sustainable development in the region, to expanding technologies and scientific cooperation, bolstering peace and security, strengthening food security.
Some analysts say Biden's 2022 vow to visit Africa is well past due. Biden originally planned to visit Angola in October, but the incoming Hurricane Milton forced him to postpone. Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow in the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
I think coming as it does at the very tail end of his administration, without much to, I think, really celebrate in terms of his involvement in Africa, I think the visit will ring rather hollow.
Lorenzo and Biden don't agree on everything. While Biden's support of Israel is ironclad, Angola aligns more with the global South's view.
Israel has the right to defend itself and protect the lives of its citizens, but the same right applies to the Palestinians, who have been living under occupation for decades, an unacceptable situation.
But one thing that they and China agree on is the urgent need for African development. China has deep inroads in the continent with its larger, more established Belt and Road Initiative. Here is a Chinese development official citing their track record over the past decade. Xi Jinping is director of China's Regional Opening Department and the National Development and Reform Commission.
Over the past 11 years, Chinese enterprises have participated in the construction and renovation of more than 10,000 kilometers of railways, nearly 100,000 kilometers of highways, nearly 1,000 bridges, about 100 ports, 66,000 kilometers of power transmission and transformation lines, and 150,000 kilometers of backbone communication networks in various African countries.
Analysts say this is not a good position for the continent to be in. While this foray to Africa's Golden Shores is a first for Biden, it is also, in a way, a final chapter. This is likely his last foreign trip, his farewell to the world as U.S. president. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
Thailand protested an incident involving Myanmar's Navy firing on Thai fishing vessels, the country's prime minister said on Sunday. After one fisherman drowned, two were injured and dozens were detained from one of the boats. Reuters correspondent Rachel Graham has more.
Ambulances were seen at the port of Ranong in southern Thailand after Myanmar's Navy opened fire on a group of Thai fishing vessels on Saturday. The incident caused one fisherman to drown, while Myanmar authorities detained 31 crew members from one of the boats, according to a spokesperson for Thailand's defense ministry. Two of 15 fishing vessels were fired at after they operated inside Myanmar's territorial waters near Ranong, the ministry initially said. But Thai Prime Minister Paetongtarn Shinawatra on Sunday questioned the claims that the boats had encroached into Myanmar waters, saying it was inconclusive. Thailand's authorities have protested the use of force during the incident and are in negotiations to release those detained. Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister Pumtan Wichayachai told reporters the country had, quote, no intention of encroaching on anything. If any side encroaches on another's sovereignty, there will be warning shots, but they don't aim to destroy targets, he said. Myanmar's ruling junta did not immediately respond to a Reuters request for comment. The country has been in crisis since 2021, when the military seized power, toppling an elected government and sparking an armed rebellion by crushing protests with lethal force.
That was Reuters correspondent Rachel Graham. Protesters rallied in Georgia's capital for a fourth straight night on Sunday, and there were signs that opposition was spreading across the country to the government's decision to suspend talks on joining the European Union. The country of 3.7 million people has seen months of rising tension between the ruling Georgian Dream Party and opponents, who accuse it of pursuing increasingly authoritarian, anti-Western and pro-Russian policies. The crisis has deepened since Thursday's announcement that the government would freeze EU talks for 4 years, with thousands of pro-EU demonstrators facing off against police armed with tear gas and water cannons. That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope. Thanks for listening.